All right, I've got with me today Brandon Sheard from Farmstead Meatsmith. Hi, Brandon.
How's it going, Paul?
It's going awesome. How's it going with you?
Good. It's wonderful. Okay. It's beautiful out here.
And I want to say thank you so much for letting me publish your videos under my YouTube channel. I feel like it's given my channel a major upgrade to have something so artistic in what's otherwise kind of a clunky channel. But I do think your videos are great, and not only that, but I recently had to go and I presented all day at a permaculture and meats thing, and I asked the group if they've seen your stuff, and they said that they hadn't, and I said, you know, it's a 12-day event. The next day is Joel Salatin presenting. And I said, between me and Joel and Owen Hablitzel and all the different presenters, the next 24 minutes will be the best takeaway for the whole 12-day event. And I showed your first video told them they have to go see the rest and told them that you're doing a Kickstarter. We should mention your Kickstarter. You got a Kickstarter going on right now.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
Yes, right now we have a Kickstarter. We're fundraising for our butcher shop and slaughter truck, which is a unique project because it's actually a butcher shop that does not sell meat, which is kind of a strange thing. But nonetheless, absolutely essential. I find that we're more of the root rather than the leaves. We are the part of the meat processing chain that you don't see, but that is the most essential thing to guaranteeing quality product, quality livestock, quality food, along with the source and the farmer.
So I know that we have set up something at Permies where you go to permies.com/meat, and that'll take you directly to the thread that's about the Kickstarter. And we have all four of your videos embedded in that thread, complete with a bunch of really awesome pictures and information about the Kickstarter, and a big fat link to Kickstarter.com to your Kickstarter.
That is excellent. Thank you.
And I hope that so far permies.com has been heavily supporting your Kickstarter. I know Kickstarter has like a little report thing in there where you can go and look and see where all the money has come from.
Absolutely.
And we've been giving you ample love, have we?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But now
I've been checking on it. I should check it right now. But, yeah, it's amazing. The permies community is serious. They're serious about this permaculture business.
Oh, yeah.
It's not something you can be flippant about. Yeah, you guys are at the top.
Awesome. We're number one, baby. But it's like you're not even halfway there yet, and the time is more than halfway gone. So we need to step it up to get this done, and we'll plot and scheme some more over the next few days. But for now, you know, it's reaching out to the pod people, go and check this out, permies.com/meat. But even more so, we asked the people. I sent out an email on my daily-ish email, and I said, okay, come to this thread and post your questions for me to ask Brandon in a podcast. And I'm sorry, there's no way I can ask all those questions in one podcast. It's like, wow, that was a response and a half. Maybe we can do half. We'll try to do half today. Maybe we're going to have to come back and do another one later, but I know the rest of my week is booked solid.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll have to think about coming back to it. But let's jump in and get started. Oh, and we should mention that the videos, which are so artfully done and so beautiful, that it was a fellow named Andrew Plotsky that put them together.
Yeah. He's got a website. It's farmrun.com, and this is what he does. He creates media for small agrarian endeavors. That is winsome and educational at the same time. He's very good at it.
Yeah, I think it's beautiful. I've watched them all now several times. I thoroughly enjoy them. All right, the first question comes from Chad Ellis. In the videos, There were shots that showed hams hanging in the home. It also talked about the butcher shop having to buy refrigerators. I would like to hear about the non-refrigerated shelf life of the products that were made in the videos, especially things like bacon and ham. Hmm.
Excellent question. Yeah, so it helps when the outdoors becomes a refrigerator. That is the key, seasonality. When you usually pigs are harvested, I should say historically, they're harvested the first cold snap of the year, which I think is like St. Andrew's Day or something like that, at the end of November. And it's at least as cold as a refrigerator outside. And so people would harvest their pig and just hang it in the barn, and the next day they would start salting things and curing things. And then by the time the salt has done its work and pulled the water out and the salt has been rinsed off, the meat has been hung, it's being hung in a drafty house or even outside in a smokehouse where it is, again, probably colder than a refrigerator. And so during that critical period, right after salting, when the pork is, it could still go bad because it still has lots of, a little bit of water in the flesh. That whole period takes place during a cold and dry time of year. So that by the time you get up to the high temperatures and higher humidity of spring and summer, the leg of prosciutto is so stable that it's going to be fine in, you know, 90-plus degrees and higher humidity.
Okay.
So basically, yeah, it's refrigeration is not essential if you do this seasonally. If you want to harvest a pig in the summer, it is a huge help to have refrigeration. But even then, you know, you can salt things. Salt is an amazing preserver, and more so than temperature, humidity affects the keeping quality of animal flesh.
In what way?
Humidity in the meat. Water is the culprit of spoilage. Free water, puddled water. That's just hanging out in the meat and in free thing in the universe to come and multiply. It is exhaust. It's just free. It's open. And so it has to be either bound or removed. And salt removes it. But I'm talking about humidity here. Let's get back on track. So humidity will hold water in the meat, basically, ambient humidity. And that will cause meat to spoil. Case in point, I have several times a whole carcass of fresh meat, of fresh pork, let's say, that has already been eviscerated, but it's two sides of pork. I've been able to keep it fresh and boiled after spending, you know, at least 12 hours in temperature for 65 degrees. But I was in eastern Wilmington, where it is as dry as a bone. It's hot, but it is dry. And pig, the fat solution on the outside, nor bacteria, because the water that is immediately on the exterior of the meat is being drawn out just by how it's being drawn out just by how dry the air is. So dryness is a huge advantage to the keeping of fresh meat.
So this technique is going to work great in the Midwest, but not so great in Florida.
Yes, and I think that's why they rely heavily upon smoking, which makes a lot of sense when you think about it. You build a drafty smokehouse, and then you use wood fire to create smoke, and wood fire soaks, you know, absorbs all the moisture in the air, and then puts off plumes of smoke, which inhibits lots of mold. It's amazing how resilient, you know, peasant economies can be, and even in humidity, people processed pigs without refrigeration in Florida for a long time, with smokehouses. I think that was the key: smokehouses and salt.
With using these techniques, how long can meat last?
You should be able to live off of one pig for 3 years. And that involves, I know that's not really the question you asked, but
okay.
So it lasts, and that's, if you cook it properly and you cure everything, it is the most economical, thrifty way to go because of our quantity. But if you're talking about fresh meat, how long does the fresh flesh of an animal last without spoiling? There's a couple factors. It depends on the animal. Ruminants, they do not, this is my theory, but which is more verified by my practice than by my scientific knowledge in this area, but ruminants eat grass, they eat plants, they're very clean. They will keep fresh for a very long time. Unless it is very humid, the fresh flesh of a ruminant, like a cow or a lamb, will just become jerky. It just dries out. It doesn't incline towards really nasty, heinous spoilage. So if, and in the case with pork, because they have a more varied diet and they tend to eat a lot of dirt, and because of the quality of their fat, their fresh flesh can be more prone to spoilage, which is why you don't dry age pork. It's enough just to chill it to the bone and then begin butchering it. The dry aging of pork needs to be aided with the addition of salt to pull water out. So if you, to actually finally answer your question, if you get a fresh pork chop of very good quality from a healthy pig, you can put that in your refrigerator. And in most refrigerators, that thing will keep for at least a week. And the reason for that is airflow. It'll just dry out. So if you put it in your refrigerator wrapped in plastic or still shrink wrapped, it'll spoil immediately, or, you know, very quickly. But if you unwrap it, put it on a plate, and maybe just put a kitchen towel over it, you can keep it in your fridge for several days. I mean, you know, 9 or 10 days, and it'll just dry out. You just have to drain the plate. Again, that which leads to spoilage is available water or free water, just puddled water. So you've got to drain that puddled water from the plate. And that pork chop will just keep for quite a while without having been frozen.
All right. I'm going to move on to the next question. And this comes from Justin Koenig, and he asked two questions, so this will be his first question. I was curious about the curing part. Much of the old-timers around here, near Memphis, Tennessee, say you couldn't do it the way they did because it doesn't get as cold or stay cold long enough. So how does the traditional way work with warmer weather? They also told me to be sure to put enough salt around everything, especially the joints. Does that sound about right?
It does. Yeah. If spoilage is going to occur, it will more than likely start at the joints because they're areas of heavy use, so they have huge blood vessels. And blood vessels carry blood, which is water-soluble or, you know, blood-soluble nutrients that anything in the universe of the bacteriological inclination can metabolize it and multiply and create havoc. So, yeah, focus salt on joints for sure.
All right. And the thing about cold enough?
Yeah, cold enough. That
I think we covered. Did we cover that earlier, or is there more to say there?
A little bit. Yeah, I think that, again, more than temperature is humidity. What examples can I think of? I have cured prosciuttos in 80-degree weather, or much more than that, much hotter. So, you know, I salt it for a few months, then hang it under an eave, and they'll be covered with mold being in the Pacific Northwest, completely green, you know, temperatures varying all over the place. I think the advantage is that I had refrigeration is I was able to start them in a refrigerator, and then move them outside. But the more important than temperature is definitely humidity. The humidity will probably enhance the degree to which molds are able to spread, because they need some water also to live. But fortunately, molds also need oxygen, so they'll just stay on the outside of the meat. They won't penetrate. So if you see something covered in mold, it's not the end of that piece of curing flesh. I've also cured, you know, it's a balance between salt and humidity. I've also cured, back in my learning days, several prosciuttos underneath the crawl space of my house towards the end of spring. And so it was up to about 67 degrees down there. And, man, it's hard. I got to define my terms here. But by curing them, I applied salt to them under the crawl space of my house, which is something you usually do in a refrigerator. And those that were covered with salt were, of course, stable, because the salt was removing the water and I was draining the water off regularly. And they were fine. After a few weeks of being salted, I could pull these legs out of the salt, rinse them, and hang them in summer temperatures in my kitchen with a bit of a draft next to a cracked window. So in that sense, the temperature was very high, but the salt was helping me control water content, which again is the more essential element. It is free or available water. That's why humidity is more important, and that's what salt helps me manage.
Question number two from Justin. I have one more question regarding boar's taint. I was under the impression that if you butcher a boar that has been away long enough from sows and heat, that he will not have that problem. But everyone around here says you gotta castrate them. But if you don't, to be sure, to cut the balls off first, right after the kill. Ask Brandon if cutting the testicles first will or does help to eliminate the taint.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. And I've heard that before as well, that if you remove the testicles right after the kill, then it won't be tainted. I have never tried that, so I don't know if that works or not. That being said, boar taint is a breed-specific thing. For pot bellies, or, you know, the that we have running around in America, testosterone is not just allocated to the testicles. So I don't know, and I think it's the testosterone that creates the taint more. And pigs like pot bellies or wild boars will develop plates on their shoulders. It's like knocking on wood. They're as hard as rocks. And they develop this armor for when they battle each other. And they'll develop long puffs. Bellies, if they are intact, because they develop these plates and it changes their physicality, they become, you know, a castrated pot belly next to one that is intact is almost a different animal in terms, even just the way they look. And the boar taint is so strong, it's not actually edible. And I've eaten a lot of things, particularly when it comes to animal flesh, but I cannot do boar tainted pot-belly flesh. It is just so heinous. So I know it is breed-specific, because animals like, or pigs like mule foots, it has been said that they do not suffer from boar taint, even if they are intact. And this, I think, I've verified that, you know, intact male mule foots, and they were delicious. But I think another factor to consider, apart from breed, is age. If a pig is allowed to mature enough, and I would, just from my experience, put the time more at about 10 or 12 months, if they're able to be in and live longer than 10 or 12 months, which is much longer than you would harvest any normal hog raised for meat, then I think the boar taint starts to set in. In their youth, it's not as intense. So I think it's a, with most breeds, they are harvested so young that the boar taint is not that intense. And that's, I've eaten, you know, intact Tamworth, Yorkshire, Berkshire, all of these guys harvested at about 8 to 10 months, and I've never had boar taint problems. It's when they're allowed to go a little longer, because they're still adolescents at that point. They're almost pork veal. You know, they're adolescent. They're very young. So it's not enough time for them to really get nasty. So I would say age and breed are the primary considerations. These have been bred, have had the intensity of boar taint bred out of them. And I can't speak, I don't know if an pig has made it last, the sows are in heat.
All right. I think our sound quality went wonky there for a minute. Thank you, Skype. Now owned by Microsoft. So, screwing things up for you whether you use Windows or not. You were talking about breeds and taint and a variety of different other things about taint. If you could repeat the last, you know, couple of minutes, that would be great.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. I think to summarize, in my experience, that which affects boar taint the most is the breed and the age of the animal when they are harvested. Fortunately, most of the pigs that we raise domestically for meat are harvested when they're adolescents. And I've eaten so many intact pigs, that is, pigs that still have their testicles, which is what leads to boar taint. And I've never had any problem with it, because they're usually harvested at about 6 to 8 months. When they're raised on a small scale at home, just two or three pigs at a time. And the only pigs I've really noticed a gnarly boar taint to the point where it's inedible is with certain breeds. And certain breeds that were allowed to mature beyond about 10 or 12 months, and particularly pot bellies. And my theory is that pigs that are closer to the wild form of domesticated hogs will be more likely to have the taint. But I've had Berkshires, Tamworth, Yorkshire, Duroc, all the standard breeds, Hampshire, that you would find on being raised on a small scale. Their boar taint is, or they do not have boar taint at about 8 months, 6 to 8 months, which is when they're usually harvested anyway. They might be, exerting excessive energy towards the growing of their testicles and the urge to mate. So you might be losing a little bit of meat production if you don't castrate them. But I don't think you'll have to struggle with boar taint, particularly with some breeds have been bred so that they don't develop it, like the mule foot, which is kind of the last American lard pig. But I think, age and breed are the primary factors there. Pot bellies, if they're allowed to live long enough, if they are intact, the boar taint will be, it's gnarly. It's unbearable.
Very terrible.
Yeah.
Okay. So, like, if a boar got to be 2 years old intact.
Yeah.
And then you said, bye-bye testicles, and then you waited another year, it's, like, too late. It's still.
You know, I don't know about that. I would
okay.
have to try.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, that's worth a try. You might find it, at the very least, adventurous to castrate a one-year-old boar. but hey, if you have the courage, go for it.
Very good point. So it sounds like if you've got a pot-bellied pig that's 3 years old, and it's not seen any females, which kind of comes back to the question. It's not hanging around any females at all.
Yeah.
It's still going to be a flavor that could be described as damn nasty.
It could be, And I say that,
I think that was,
because if they get their, if they are able to do their thing, which is mate, and they need to do it a certain amount of times a year to not be incredibly ornery and frustrated. I don't know how proximity to a sow might affect that. I think it's more a timing issue, if you know what I'm saying. And I don't know how often a boar needs to mate. It's kind of like dogs. Dogs, male dogs need to mate every 6 months or else they get really frustrated. That's an interesting thing. I know that timing and, or, you know, age and breed are the primary factors in affecting boar tame.
When you raise hogs and you're thinking that here's, you know, three or four boys in the litter, are you going to cut them or are you going to leave them?
Well, I think that another consideration is they will impregnate each other as soon as is porcinely possible. The moment they are sexually mature, to the minute, they will be impregnated. Something I encounter a lot is, they were only in the same pen. You know, he only escaped once. He only got to the gills, you know, for a few minutes. But it is almost a 100% guarantee that they will be impregnated. So I think an even more present consideration when you're talking about castration is proximity to gilts, to female pigs, because, man, they will impregnate them instantly if they are allowed to. That being said, personally, I would like to focus on breeds that don't struggle with boar taint so that you don't have to struggle with castration, even though it is very easy to do on your own. If someone shows you, you just have to be shown. It's very simple. I would focus on mulefoot and tamworth because I found that boar taint is not so much an issue with them. You just have to be prepared. You might be harvesting a pregnant gilt, and you have to decide whether or not that's something you're willing to do.
Okay. So now, what's the youngest that they become sexually active?
You know, I think that's a breed thing. I don't know the exact age. It's also an old thing. With tamworth, I know I've had young tamworth that were impregnated by one of their brothers at around 10 months, it was about 8 or 10 months in that window. And, it's very... That's just the very beginnings of pregnancy because we harvested them at about a year. And they were smaller because they lived almost exclusively on their mama, the sow, and what they could forage in a very large 5-acre field before we got them, which is why they were smaller, I think is why they took so long to get together. But there's so many factors in that. And when it comes to a pig that is fed on grain and grown quickly, I don't know when they become sexually mature. I keep finding it different from breed to breed.
Okay. I guess I'm just kind of used to the old school thing being that at 6 weeks they're weaners, and so you'll wean them from their mom.
Right, yes.
And then at about 5 months you're harvesting, maybe even earlier.
Yeah, and that is... Again, that's breed-dependent, too. You know, a Yorkshire will hang out by the food bowl all day long. They understand the trough. That is something that they are bred to grasp very well. Whereas if you're raising a tamworth, they're not going to hang out by the trough. They're going to be out grazing for, the morning and the evening, the parts of the day that aren't crazy hot. And so they're going to grow much slower, whereas the Yorkshire is going to be consuming all the protein-rich food it can. So, yeah, I think 5 to 6 months is pretty short for a pig that is going to be raised on a small scale with the ability to forage, especially if you're moving it, you know, in a smaller paddock to graze on fresh forage. If all it has is the hog mash that you're feeding it, it will grow much quicker because it will be getting more high-protein feed as its sole source of nutrients.
Okay.
Usually I like to let my pig go to 6 or 8 to 10 months because I like the slow growth, and I want them to put on copious amounts of fat.
Okay. Next question comes from Carrie Rogers. I just bought a side of steer from an individual I know here in Texas. I'm comfortable that it was a well-raised, only chem-free, pasture-fed animal. The farmer had it custom processed at a small processor that does that kind of work. And I stayed up till 3 a.m. on the night before, Googling to try to learn how to complete the very vaguely worded cutting form, never having done this sort of thing. About 6 weeks later, the farmer brought mini boxes of frozen packages to my house. So far, I'm happy with the meat. It tastes clean compared to grass-fed grocery store beef. I'd like to hear Brandon's thoughts about this kind of processor. I met the farmer, but not the processor. Did they likely do anything unseemly there? Should I have met them? I don't even know how the meat was aged. Did they add chemistry? I guess the main thing I want to know is, what typically goes on in these small commercial operations, and how should I research and or vet the processor next time?
That is a really good question. Well, I'm surprised someone is that attentive to small-scale processing. That's awesome. So, what usually goes on in terms of a custom slaughter, if you bought an animal, and I'm assuming this is the context she's talking about, because usually this is the only context that small-scale processing occurs. If you purchase an animal on the hoof, by the side, or the whole, or the quarter, and it sounds like she got a whole side. And so what would happen is they would show up in a truck, usually, and it's a mobile slaughter unit. It's not certified by the federal government, but it would be certified by the state. And to process livestock for the consumption of the farmer. And when you buy an animal on the hoof, you are the farmer because you own the live animal. And so this guy will show up in his truck. Hopefully it will only take one bullet to drop the cow, and then he will bleed it out. And then he will eviscerate and skin the cow on site on the farm, and then he'll roll it into his hopefully refrigerated truck. They don't have to be, depending on which state regulation or what the state requires. And then he will take it to his butcher shop, where he will butcher it and wrap it for you, hopefully allowing it to hang for a while. This is the market that we are trying to get into as Farmstead Meatsmith. These are the butchers that a lot of them are associated with retail sales of butchered meat, but they provide this essential service of small-scale processing for farmers or for people who buy animals on the hoof. And the unique thing about these guys, as opposed to retail butchers that you see in big cities or even in small ones, is that they are involved in every step of the process. These are the actual butchers. They slaughter and they butcher a whole carcass, whereas the guys in the retail butcher shops, they do not even butcher whole carcasses, much less slaughter them. They will get subprimals. They'll get semi-largish chunks of meat that they that have probably already been trimmed, and then they'll cut them into smaller increments to put into their butcher case. But it's these guys, the custom slaughter, custom butchers, who are engaged in the entire process on a local level. So I feel like they are the most essential link in the chain. And if we're going to reinvent the wheel with this whole thing, this is where it's, that's why this has been our focus. Anyway, so he will bring it to his walk-in, to answer the question, and he will hang it usually for 12 to 14 days, which is not very long, particularly for grass-fed beef. And then he will butcher it and discard 30% of the carcass weight. And that is standard, at least 30%. And you can ask them, and they'll tell you, because this isn't a secret. This is standard operating procedure. There's a certain amount of trim, and there's a certain amount of musculature and bone that you discard. And this is not including the skin and the offal. You might not even get the option to get the offal or the hide or the head back or even the shins. This is just the meat, the carcass hanging in the walk-in. They discard about 30% of that. So if you want to engage these guys, you've got to find out who is processing them. And you have to tell them what you want because this is your animal. And they should listen to you, again, because it is your animal if you purchased it on the hoof. It is standard for them to discard 30%, which is a shame, and to only age for 12 to 14 days. And this is why grass-fed beef is looked down upon in terms of flavor. It's considered tough and gamey. This is not because grass-fed cows are tough and gamey. It's because they are processed incorrectly. They're processed as though they are they're produced in a feedlot. They're processed like the grain-fed cows that are finished in massive, horrific feedlots all over the nation. But you can't process a cow that's raised, you know, four or five at a time, like a cow that's, you know, raised with 400 and processed by the thousands in a week. A grass-fed beef cow needs to be aged for at least 28 days. It needs to break down because it doesn't have lots of grain fat in it. It has grass fat, which is the saturated fat that tastes better and is better for you. And it's not as prolific. Fat is the key to tenderness. And so to compensate where it doesn't have all this grain fat, you have to age it for at least for about a month so that the meat can begin to break down and become tender through this controlled spoilage, is what I like to call it. It doesn't go bad, it goes good. The proteins actually soften and they become more chewable and it becomes more tender. And again, no one on the small scale does this. They process these beautiful grass-fed cows as if they are grain-fed, conventionally grown cows, almost negating all of the wonderful things that were put into the cow by being grass-fed, which makes eating beef more like eating the nasty vegetables, like it's a chore. But grass-fed beef is the most delicious thing in the universe. It tastes like milk. It smells like milk, and it tastes like butter. It's just unbelievable. It's the most flavorful beef. And this is particularly why we want to break into beef processing, because it is a tragedy to throw away 30% of the carcass and to not age it long enough. And that was a really long answer. Hope that makes a little
sense. No, really long answers are perfectly fine. I do know that there's always that question of whether or not the meat you're getting back is the meat that you raised.
Right.
A lot of times butchers will see a lot of meat come by and they're like, wow, this is a really good cut. I'm going to just give them the crappy cut. I'm going to either keep the cut for myself or I'm going to sell it through a different venue where I can get a lot more money for it because it's good. Mm-hmm. And this kind of leads back to where I like what Farmstead Meatsmith is all about, where it's like, do your own. And so build those skills and do your own to be sure. And I've had some people say that they've gotten some meat back where they were able to prove that it was not the meat that they sent in.
Yeah.
And I've heard lots of those kinds of stories. Yeah. And then it kind of comes back to the whole thing of like especially with pork, when you send it off to a place like that, it's like, oh, you got to put the nitrates in it. And
right.
And they've got their own recipes and techniques that probably do not meet your organic or beyond organic standards.
Right.
Which, right there, I think is a great question. I know that. So I'm going to ask you a loaded question.
Sure.
My favorite kind. Brandon, do not care for organic. I think organic is a very low standard.
Yeah.
I think that when in the permaculture realm, we a lot of the things that we do are way, way, way beyond organic, and organic is disgusting.
Yeah.
But hey, Brandon, how do you feel about organic?
Yeah, I think the organic is a product. It reflects commodification more than it is a reflection of food production.
Okay.
So I think the worst thing about organic is it allows consumers to not think about what they are eating or purchasing because it says organic. So you can just buy it and be safe. You don't have to think about it. And I think the greatest evil, the greatest detriment to our entire food system is for consumers to not think about what they are consuming. It's not necessarily that terrible things are being produced, which is terrible, I mean, obviously. But the only way that is going to be changed is if people demand more from what is being produced and start producing their own. And in order to demand more, you need to know more. And the way to know more is to do more yourself. So I think these labels are mystifying. They make you unable to think about or unwilling to think about what went into the food. I definitely would not put too much stock in organic. It is designed to sell things. It is a market force. It is not an agricultural force.
Right. I think that organic is certainly a big step up over what the USDA quantifies as food.
Yeah.
And then, of course, all of the stuff that doesn't make that is what is usually being fed to animals,
right,
which is extremely substandard. But next question comes from Corey Berkey. I am very interested in more in-depth details on the curing process, especially when it's warmer weather.
Mm.
Also, what would be the best route to start a similar business to what Brandon and his family have done? Uh-oh, you got competition.
Oh, man, yeah. As soon as you figure that out, let me know.
I have self-taught myself how to kill and butcher my own pigs. My last pig had the best bleeding thanks to his videos. I'm about to do my last large black. I would love to purchase the Kickstarter that flies him out so I could learn from him, but it would be 2 years till I'm at that point in life. Would he do consulting on how to start your own meatsmith?
Hmm.
I think there's lots of questions in there.
Yes,
it's going to take you half an hour. Maybe I should go get a snack while you talk.
Yeah, well, remind me of the first one. Maybe we could try to do it in order.
Okay. All right, let's see. I'm very interested in more in-depth details on the curing process.
Okay.
Especially when it's warmer weather.
Okay. So the thing about the curing process is that there are not lots of in-depth details because it is so absurdly simple. That being said, we will try to over-detail it with some scientific language. With the example of pork, because that is what is mostly cured in the West, curing means removing water, available water from the meat. There are two categories in my mind that distinguish for curing. There's whole muscle curing and then there's salami. Whole muscle curing is a slab of meat that is salted in some way, either in a wet brine or a dry rub of salt. Salami is meat that has been ground, which is chopped into very little tiny pieces by a machine and then salted to cure that way. Neither of them, or both of them, can be eaten raw. Depending on the application, they can also be cooked. Salami is a completely different ball game than the whole muscle curing. So I'm going to talk about the whole muscle curing. Whole muscle curing examples are bacon, pancetta, prosciutto, guanciale, lomo, lardo. Basically, just chunks of meat that are salted. That is all bacon is. That is all a prosciutto is. The application of salt to the flesh through the process of osmosis and through the process of, which is the water in the cells of the meat seeking a balance with the salt that is outside the meat, it creates an exchange. The water comes out towards the salt, dissolves the salt, and the salt, dissolved salt, goes back into the cell. But more pulling out of water is what occurs. This is basically binding water and removing water. That's how it cures it. It binds it by making it very salty and thereby inhospitable to pathogens and spoilage bacteria, but very hospitable to curing bacteria, which, maybe I won't go down that path. Doesn't happen so much with large whole muscle cures. Basically, a prosciutto or bacon, they are just dried out. They are what happen when you dry out pork. What happens when you dry out beef is you get jerky. When you dry out pork, you get prosciutto. This is why the pig is very special and magical, because it doesn't taste like jerky. It tastes like pork butter. You don't taste salt if it's properly done. It is nutty. It is sweet. It's incredible. Salt is the means to that end, by removing water and binding water. It basically just dries it out. That's all it is. Water is the culprit. That is all the curing process is. So in pork, that manifests itself by a period in salt, in cooler temperatures, a refrigerator being ideal because it is insect and rodent proof generally, but a cool cellar can do this as well. Do this in the winter. If you can't do it in the winter, do it in your fridge. There's the curing process, which is the salting process. Stage two is the drying process, which is basically to store meat that is salted. Is not just been flavored in stage one, it's also been preserved, and it will keep indefinitely. That's why, someone mentioned before, you see chunks of ham hanging in my kitchen. It is aging there for flavor purposes, but it's also just being stored there. Preservation happens to be contiguous and not contrary to delicification. It tastes really good when it is preserved this way. So stage one is the salting. Stage two is the rinsing of the salt. After enough water has been removed, you rinse the salt off, dry it off, and you hang it. The longer it hangs, the more the salt equalizes throughout the meat, which means the less salt you will taste. In the case of prosciutto, you don't really want to taste that much salt at all. The point is to taste the pig. And the salt is the means to the end of tasting the pig. It is not the end of tasting, salty, fatty pork, even though that is a good thing in and of itself, but that's not the point of prosciutto. So that's the curing process. Salting, rinsing, and hanging. Hanging is a way to slowly dry the pork over a period of time, but it has been rendered stable. The water has been bound and or removed through the salting, through the first stage. I hope that makes sense.
All right. Yes. And then I just peeled off the last bit of his question for the other part. Would he do consulting on how to start your own meat smith?
Oh, man. Yes, I would do consulting. the first thing you will learn as a meat smith is that you can't do consulting for free. this is the nature of a small business. The thing about consulting is that it is very state-specific. Because Farmstead Meatsmith, our category is custom slaughter, custom butcher, which is different from the category of retail butcher shop. We do not sell meat. We are the root. We aren't the leaves that everybody sees. We aren't the commodified, acidified projection of the meat processing world for the background. We enable vegetable farmers to feed their families and to harvest their own flesh properly, the flesh of their own animals properly. So that is something that's regulated by the state, not by the federal government. So each state has their different regulations, and the part of the state that you need to get in touch with to find out what those regulations are is the agricultural department. And generally, the agricultural department will defer their inspection duties, meaning when they show up and check out your system, to the county health department. That's kind of the pattern. So, insofar as regulations are specific to each state, I know Washington state regulations, and it just so happens that they require a butcher shop and a slaughter truck, hence our current Kickstarter campaign to fund the construction of those two things. I think that's pretty standard across the state, but if I can give any advice in that regard, I will definitely give it. just get in touch with me.
All right. And of course, you know, you now spend some time at permies.com. So
they
could ask there. Yeah.
They can ask there.
Yeah. Next question is from Dave Hartman. I have a really small pot-bellied pigs. No, I have really small pot-bellied pigs that weigh around 60 pounds.
Beautiful.
At about a year old. Brandon, have you ever processed such small pigs? Can you describe in what ways would you get the best cuts on this type of hog? I understand there will be no bacon cuts. I have wondered if just I know, but it goes on. Let me finish the thing, and then you can, yeah. We can go back if we need to. I have wondered if just cooking the whole hog pit style would be the best option. I will be raising many of these per year, and would like to try some traditional curing. But is this possible with such small pigs? I raise these small type hogs because they are very easy on my small permstead, and they forage on grasses and dandelions. I would love to hear any suggestions you may have. Thank you for all that you do. Are you interested in doing any workshops in central Montana? I'm sure you've heard of Montana before.
Sure.
All right, where do you want to start? Do you want me to read some of these over again?
No, I think I can do it.
Okay.
Yeah, but if you think I forget anything, just let me know.
Right.
The pot belly, I am a huge fan of small pigs. Pot belly, Cooney Cooney, American guinea hogs. It is exactly the reverse of what you have been told. I don't know who told you this heinous lie, but pot bellies are, they should all be turned into bacon, their entire body. They are very fat pigs. That is the best way to capitalize on their physicality. To get the most out of a potbelly or a smaller pig, you cure all of it. Generally, these smaller pigs are lard pigs. They're not meat types. We've been turning them into pets for so long that we forgot to breed them into, you know, excessively meaty, lean pigs like we have with the Yorkshire. So they've retained their lardishness, which is so good. They're extreme fat. A potbelly pig at a year old, which I think he said, which is great, which means they will be incredibly fatty, because after about 6 or 8 months, they stop putting on lean meat and they just start packing on the fat all under their skin, to the point where for the back fat, you'll have about 3 or 4 inches of back fat. So the pig is going to be, you know, almost more fat than actual lean meat, the entirety of the carcass. Fat has less water in it than flesh. I think flesh is at about 70% or something. So it is much more conducive to curing. Particularly these pigs, if you have fed them well, if they've been able to graze, they will have a higher percentage of saturated fat. If you fed them exclusively on corn and soy, they'll have lots of unsaturated fat, which is still okay. Those ones you should roast whole. Even then, you know, you should still harvest them for bacon. But the saturated fat, which has even less water than unsaturated fat, will cure very well. These are the pigs that were, back in the day, pigs were not harvested for their fresh flesh, for their pork chops or their spare ribs. They were cured. Every single ounce of them was cured so that people would not die during the wintertime, but also so that they would eat extremely delicious food during the wintertime. That's what these pigs are made for, these lard pigs. They're bred for their fat, and the fat is to be cured. In 1830, a guy named William Cobbett said that a pig is too lean if he can walk for 200 yards. If he is too fat to walk for 200 yards, then you should harvest him. And he said that lean bacon is totally useless to the working man and woman. This is a guy who's writing to people who work for 60 hours a week, and then, in addition to that, had to raise their own food to provide for their families. His prescription for them was solid fat bacon. Your bacon needs to be composed exclusively of saturated thick fat. So we're talking bacon, you know, a belly that is about 3 or 4 inches thick, because they, like you, would let these pigs live for a year long. And with this fat, they would start their day with bacon, beer, and bread, all of their own making, and they could work all day without lunch, because fat has more energy in it. So I am very passionate about pot bellies. I'm very passionate about their fat content and their size, because, like you said, they fit on a permaculture design. They're so manageable. I think everyone should have at least 2 potbelly pigs. They're so awesome, and they should all be cured. Which means they should all be scalded and scraped at slaughter, not skinned, which is another thing we might get into a little later, because scalding and scraping retains all the fat and the skin. It doesn't remove it. Did I get everything in that one?
I think so. I was kind of trying to read it while you're – but actually, I was paying more attention to what you're saying. But I think so. I think you did. I think you did. And I think this is a good time to talk about – I mean, of course, the skin. I think –
yeah.
In the previous podcast that I have with you, which many people have said is like in the top 5 of all of the 255 podcasts that we've put out so far, they said it's in the top 5. That's a lot of people have said that. I think we did talk about the great importance of keeping the skin. So
yeah.
I think that one's covered.
Yeah.
Next question is from Jacob Wessner. He asked 2 questions, so I did divide this one up. The first question is, has Brandon ever experimented with using only honey in the curing process and eliminated the use of cane sugar?
Yes. With potbellies, it so happens. Here in Washington, I did several potbellies for a really awesome farm, Moon Valley Organics, actually. They produce lots of awesome, incredible honey and skin products, all from ingredients they grow on their farm, from calendula to the honey to everything. Anyway, they had pot bellies, and being beekeepers, they had copious amounts of honey. So, yes, the answer is yes. The very simple answer to that question is yes. We just did coarse sea salt for all the cures and a lot of honey, probably about equal parts salt to honey. And you can do this either in the dry rub method, which would be the coarse sea salt and the honey, which is a very goopy, messy thing, but nonetheless works, or in a brine. You can dissolve the honey and the salt in a brine. Honey is excellent. Yes, use honey. It is dehydrating as well. It has the same effect. That's why you get thirsty when you drink honey, right? It pulls water out, so it has a similar osmotic effect as salt, and even cane sugar has a slight osmotic effect. So, yes, do use honey. Please use honey. It's awesome.
And the next question from Jacob Wessner is, for using brine or salt for washing his cutting boards and other wooden surfaces, does he soak the wood in brine, just use it as a rinse, or does he use a straight-up salt scrub when washing these items? I'm really interested in this idea of promoting the good bacteria on your butcher tools, so any more info on that would be awesome.
Yes, the answer to all of those is yes, because they'll all have the same effect. Yeah, if you want to submerge the entire cutting board in a brine, that's fine. That sounds like a lot of work. If you want to use it, so here's what I do. I go into my kitchen and I put a largish pinch, maybe a tablespoon of salt into a mug, and then I get my faucet in my kitchen running hot, and I pour that water into the mug, and the hot water instantly dissolves all the salt. And then I go to my cutting board, and with my chopping block, I have a big wire brush that I use. My chopping block is huge, so I don't think you need to go quite this far, or to any cutting board, and with some steel wool or even just a coarse side of a Scotch-Brite sponge, use the brine to vigorously scrub your cutting board surface. That's what I do. And then I will rinse it off with some more brine. Use what's left in the mug to rinse it off and then dry it off. And you're leaving lots of salt on the cutting board, which is the point. So all 3 of those methods would work. That's what I just described is what I do.
So then all of the good bacteria are like, yay, I'm clean. And all the bad bacteria are like, help me, I'm dying. Kind of like that?
Well, more or less. Yeah, yeah. You know, they don't like salt. Lactic bacteria and human beings like salt. That's why we do well. Why our food.
Okay. All right. So next question is from Stephen Bublitz. He had this huge list of questions. And in fact, out of all the stuff that he asked, I pulled out six. And I'm going to wrap up this podcast with his six questions that I picked out from a much bigger list. So question one of six.
Yeah.
What was the process through which you learned this amazing skill and became able to execute it, no pun intended, with such beauty and grace?
That's a very kind question. I learned this through necessity. I worked at a small farm on Vashon here that also opened up a butcher shop in Vashon town that is no longer open. But it was a really neat, it is still a farm, and it's a really neat agrarian endeavor because it is a diversified farm that only sells fresh meat. The best thing about it is that it is culinarily focused. The beauty about the cosmos is that if you pursue the goal of culinary excellence truly, single-mindedly, and to its fullest extent, you happen to fall into the most responsible and the most economical, sustainable way to raise the meat, because permaculture and culinary ends are not divergent. They should not be. That should not be the case. Good farming serves good cookery. In fact, it's the only thing that guarantees good cookery. So that was the focus of this place that I worked at for exactly 2 years. And I happened to come on and be hired during a crisis, which means the entire farm and the butcher shop and our farmers markets were understaffed. So there were four or five of us running the farm, which involved a winery, a creamery, a dairy, raising, slaughtering two or three pigs a week, three or four lambs a week, 50 chickens a week, and selling them all fresh, creating our own sausage. It was also a restaurant, and running the restaurant that was attached to the butcher shop. So this was an insane time of hustling, shall we say. And so I jumped right in when it was understaffed, which means anyone that could pick up where things were needed to be done could do it and could learn everything. There was no training involved, so I got to pursue exactly what I wanted to, which happened to be traditional peasant charcuterie, which is the end of all proper processing and farming. Because the best way to get the most economic value, but also the best value in your kitchen, out of a pig is to make things like head cheese and liver pate, to pickle the pig's feet. You can't just throw that stuff away. That's detrimental economically and in every other way. So traditional processing, traditional charcuterie happened to be the best way to make the business work. So that's what we did. That's what I did. And that's where I took the butcher shop there. I had started by selling the meat, so I knew the finished cuts because I would manage the farmers markets. And I worked backwards from the culinary end, from the cookery. The best way to learn how to butcher a pig is to know how to cook it, because butchery serves cookery. Outside of cookery, it has no purpose. It's not, you know, a really cool rock star art. It is for the home cook. It is to enable the home kitchen to be more economical and delicious. And so if you can start by knowing how to cook a pig, then you can figure out how to butcher a pig. If you can butcher a pig without cooking it, you're a useless butcher. Anyway, so that's how I started. I would follow the culinary path first and work backwards from there.
I want to say that the best pork dish I've ever had was pork belly served at Riverside Cafe in Missoula. And I know that he, like every few weeks, receives a pig, which he processes himself. I think within the restaurant. I'm not sure about that. But I know he processes it himself. And the last time I was there, he brought out head cheese. But the best dish I've ever had is pork belly, which is usually made into bacon instead of pork belly. But now that I've expressed this, I want to ask you, sir,
yeah,
what has been the best pork dish you've ever had?
Oh, man. The one that was cooked properly.
I don't care if it's cooked properly or not. I'm thinking what has been the most delicious.
Yeah, that's really hard to say. Man.
And, of course, this pork belly, of course, had the skin on it so crunchy.
Right.
And then, it, you know, the fat with, he had some kind of glaze that was a little sweet.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, the hard thing, man, that is hard. Because I have been so engaged in the making of all of the pork dishes in our family and for my work and for sustaining our life, I find that it is impossible to divorce the flavor from what goes into it. And so I think some of the best pork I've ever had has been spit roasted. Oh, man. The moment I cook something, I think of something else. This is really difficult. Yeah.
I have asked a question which tortures you.
It does. Very difficult. All right, I'm going to rewind for a second here. The most, in terms of sheer deliciosity, would have to be the prosciutto hanging in my kitchen right now. The reason they're hanging there right now and why I picked them right now is because it took them over a year to make. So I've made several prosciuttos. And prosciutto, because it is about the pork. It's not about the salt. The salt is the means to the end of the flavor. And so if you do a prosciutto correctly, when you finally cut into it after a year or, more properly, 2 years, you don't taste any salt. You taste the essence of pork. It's like the distilled liquor of pig flesh. That is what prosciutto is. You've removed all the water. You've evaporated it. It's gone. And what's left is the essence of the pig. And the essence of the pig is what it ate and where it lived and how it was processed. That's what prosciutto represents. And so if you've done it properly, prosciutto doesn't taste salty. It tastes like nuts, like cashews that have been browned in butter that has been cultured from raw cream. It is so amazing. The flavor is... it is even sweet. It's got a honey, like a browned honey flavor to it. So I would have to say prosciutto. And this is, these are just shavings. You know, we eat it raw. So it's been hanging in my kitchen for a year, and we cracked into it a little while ago, and it's almost already halfway gone. And this is unanimous amongst my family. And I want to encourage people to try this. My babies eat this. I have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old and a 4-month-old boy, all boys. And my 2-year-old runs up to me several times throughout the day and asks for prosciutti, by which he means prosciutto. And they love it because it is objectively, universally delicious. I would have to say prosciutto. And then the eyes of roasted pig and the jowls of spit roasted pig. And, you know, I could go on. But prosciutto is probably up there at the top.
Next question. How do you suggest a person start learning about meatsmithing? Do you have book or other resource recommendations?
Yes. Okay. So resource recommendations are easy because that's a list. I can do a list. So Jane Grigson is my favorite author. Grigson. Charcuterie and French Pork Cookery is her book. It is excellent. It is anecdotal and historical. She's British, so she knows how to write. it is wonderful. It has peasant French recipes for every ounce of the pig. And it doesn't have the typical heavy-handedness or pugnaciousness of an American cookbook. It is culinary, which serves the purpose of health and economy and good flavor. So it is just awesome. That is at the top, Jane Grigson. The other series that I enjoy is part of what we reviewed for the podcast, the last podcast we did, which is the River Cottage series. Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall produced the River Cottage Cookbook and the River Cottage Meat Book, and these focus on principles rather than recipes. I think recipes engender fear more than anything else, and methods and principles create confidence and ability, and that's what he focuses on. It's not divided by recipes, but it's divided by cooking method and principles of meat cookery. So the meat book focuses on the fresh end of meat preparation, fresh cooking. The cookbook, even though meat is not in the title, is what actually covers the curing end of things. In both cases, neither author starts by saying something like, if you cure salami, if you embark on this journey to make salami, you could die a horrific and painful death. So use nitrites. Now go for it. That, to me, is a very discouraging way to begin curing things, and that's how all American cookbooks pertaining to charcuterie are written, the opposite of empowering, in my mind. Jane Grigson and Hugh Whittingstall don't go that direction. They mention nitrates as optional, and in fact, they refer to it as saltpeter, and which is a slightly different thing, but not really. It's more a matter of personal taste. So I would go to those first. How to become a meatsmith, I would say start by putting yourself in the position to need to be a meatsmith, which was my journey. So I can only speak to what I know. I didn't go to Europe and learn the trade, which would be awesome, and probably the only place where you could actually learn how to do it. I don't think it really happens in America. But it's only in Europe because they learn through necessity as well. And I think vegetable farmers are a great example of this. A lot of vegetable farmers are my customers. And by vegetable farmers, I mean small-scale people who are going to the local farmer's market, and that is their only venue of selling their vegetables. So, you know, 5 acres in the Pacific Northwest. They can't afford to buy organic meat, but they can raise lots of veg, and they can feed their pigs on lots of veg, which makes wonderful pork. So they want to know how to produce it, so they call me to teach them how to do it on a peasant scale, which is simple and pretty much means all you need in terms of ingredients and expertise is the ability to salt things. And I would start by needing to do it. So I can't think of any school or training regimen. Raise a pig, try to get the most out of it, and learn how to cook it, and work backwards from that.
Next question. Have you had any regulatory pressures from the Department of Making You Sad? How did you circumvent or resolve those issues?
Well, part of my strategy for resolving those issues is this Kickstarter campaign. Because what the regulatory agency in my state, which is the Washington State Department of Agriculture, requires is a butcher shop and slaughter truck. Fortunately, no one in the universe wants me to have a butcher shop and slaughter truck more than I do, because that means I don't have to do this in my wife's kitchen anymore, which puts unnecessary strains on our household. So, yes, that's the Department of Regulation that I have had to deal with. The cool thing about, which is what all you would have to deal with if you're going to try to go do what I'm doing, you don't have to go with the USDA. You only have to deal with the USDA if you're trying to sell meat retail, which means you're trying to sell pork chops. You're trying to sell individual cuts. I'm not doing that. I am trying to empower farmers and even hobby farmers and foodies in the to enhance the economy of their kitchen and the generosity of their table. So I don't have to deal with them. Usually, agricultural departments of the individual states are pro-agriculture. Believe it or not, they want to see the agriculture of their state succeed. And I think in Washington, they know that where agriculture is going in this state, which happens to be more localized, more specialized, and smaller scale. You can see this just by going to the farmers markets in Seattle. There are so many of them, and they are huge, and it's a really strong force. And so I think you have a much better go at it because you have to deal with the state agricultural department. They're pro-agriculture in general. So basically, I've always been straightforward and honest about our processing and what we do and about the fact that I am doing everything that is humanly possible to become licensed in certain ways without compromising all the integrity of my business. So, yeah, deal with the state agricultural departments to become a custom slaughter and custom butcher. It's very doable.
Next question. Where do you get your knives, and what do you do to maintain them yourself? How did you learn that skill?
Good question. So I have to mention, because it is such a pertinent answer to this very good question, that one of the rewards to our Kickstarter campaign is a knife consultation. And what this would involve is me divulging everything I know about knives and what I've learned, particularly as someone who makes his living on the sharpness of his knife. Because a dull knife will crush your soul if you try to do this for any extended amount of time. It is the most discouraging thing. And it is, I'll leave it at that. So I get my knives used. All of my knives are used. I do not buy any new knives. My only criteria is that the steel have a high degree of carbon in it. So high carbon steel blades is what you're looking for. The way to spot them is by the telltale staining on the blades because they are not stainless steel. Stainless steel is for common tools like tables and mixing bowls. It is not for knives. High carbon steel will have a patina on it. It may even be completely rusted over. If you find a knife at an antique store or a garage sale that is covered in rust, that's exactly the knife that you want because it is not made out of stainless steel. Stainless steel is a soft steel that is therefore very strong. It is flexible, but you cannot get a fine edge on it. Only carbon steel can do that. It is much harder and therefore brittle, but you shouldn't be trying to open a paint can with a knife anyway, so you won't be chipping it. You'll just be cutting meat with it. So go for the carbon steel every time. I rarely pay more than $12 for a knife because I find them in antique stores. I look for rusted, stainless, or stained, dirty knives anytime I go to a new place and scope out the antique shops.
And to maintain them?
To maintain them, I would actually learn from someone. I tried to figure it out myself for 2 years to no avail, and I can generally figure stuff out, but sharpening knives is an art form. Even separate from making knives, sharpening knives is a whole other world to get into. I personally use Japanese water stones rather than oiled stones. I think they're more efficient. Don't waste your time on jigs that set the angle for you or those funny little things that, those ceramic things that you draw the knife through. You will not develop a skill and you will not achieve a very sharp blade. The most valuable thing you can do is learn how to tell if a knife is sharp. And rubbing your thumb perpendicularly across the edge and trying to shave hairs off your arm and putting nicks in your fingernail are not ways to prove that a knife is sharp, by the way. If you want to know how a knife is sharp, you should go to CarterCutlery.com. By the Knife Sharpening Fundamentals DVD that he produced there. He will tell you how to tell if a knife is because shaving sharp is not that sharp, believe it or not. There's scary sharp. And he's got great resources there for that and only everything I know about it and everything I've learned about it if you check out our Kickstarter campaign. It's a long discussion. It takes a while. But ultimately, like all pure things, it is simple. And once you get the basic understanding, you can work with it for the rest of your life with the sharpness of your knife.
All right. Does your meat smithing go beyond hogs? Do you also butcher chickens, cattle, wild game, etc.? Do you have plans to make informational videos on that too? For your information, I'd be willing to shell out a little bit of dough for videos as high of quality as Anatomy of Thrift.
Absolutely, yes. Well, currently, we process all of those things. Pork, goat, lamb, chickens, rabbits, everything. The success of this Kickstarter campaign will enable us to do is to process beef. Being massive animals, they require stronger stuff than my back to lift them and hoist their carcasses around. So that's part of what this butcher shop and slaughter truck will enable me to do is have cranes and hoists to, not crush me under their weight. So I have done beef, but it doesn't quite work with our current setup. So yes, we do all of those things, and one of the primary purposes of this butcher shop is that it will also be our film studio. And Andrew and I work so well together. One of the benefits of it being Andrew is that he also happens to be my employee/apprentice. So he can film and create media around what we as the meatsmiths do with the eye of someone who knows how to do it, which is a humongous advantage. It's hard to describe without if you've experienced it. But he is particularly suited to create beautiful things. And so that's what we want to work with the entire time. That's the point of this Kickstarter campaign, is I want the shop and the trucks that me and Andrew can do. And one of the first top things in my mind is I want to create a lamb slaughter video because if you can slaughter and eviscerate and skin a lamb properly, then you can do that with an antelope that you shoot in the plains. You can do that with a goat. You can do that with a deer. Any good ruminant. It's all the same program. So, yeah, that's the whole point of Bush right now in our campaign, is I want to have more of these things. We do a really good job at it, and we love doing it, and it serves people well.
Last question. On the more metaphysical side of things, have you ever had difficulty in killing an animal? Did you have a period of adjustment to taking an animal's life, or did you naturally understand the relationship between death, life, animal, human?
I think that I had an advantage in so far as my personality in general, I think of things abstract, and them in abstraction, then I can do them in a concrete world. And for me, what is contingent, being able to harvest and take the life of an animal is contingent upon being able to use it. So I did not feel myself able or willing, which is 90% of the battle. Most people are able to do this. It is the willingness that counts. if I'm willing to harvest the whole animal and to cook the whole animal, and not just cook it, but cook it extremely well, then I can understand taking that animal's life. Because if you can cook it, and if you can put that animal on your table, suddenly the animal becomes more than just a biological expiration of a monetarily delineated value. You know, it's not just a bottom line we're working with here. It is the life breath of a living being on this planet. So when I bring it to my table, it has to be more than just filling the hole, filling the hunger hole. It even has to be more than just healthy. It has to be hospitality. It has to be gratitude. And the best way to express that is to invite people to your table. They does not give their life for filling the hole, for satisfying human hunger. Their death becomes a sacrifice, which is a noble thing. Sacrifice is the most noble thing I think anything can do on this planet, is to sacrifice oneself. If at your table the dignity of the animal is asserted in the hospitality and the people that you bring and how delicious the dish is, it would be a sad state of affairs if the pig died for a dry, chalky pork chop, which is the standard in American cookery and in the grocery store today. That's hugely that doesn't elevate the dignity of the pig, which is the beauty of harvesting lambs or all animals in the traditional way. They will submit. It's amazing. If you respect an animal's nature, just as in the farming, like all the beautiful stuff that Joel Salatin talks about, if you enable an animal of livestock to live in a way that respects its nature, back to you. The exact same equation with processing. If you acknowledge and respect the nature of the animal, take its life, the way that you take its life, then it will give back to you. And, I could get into slaughter methods, but you've got to respect the individual nature of each animal and the way you harvest it, all the way to the way you prepare it. And that's how it made sense to me. I never eat an animal that I haven't harvested by, or that has been harvested by someone I don't, only because I'm in the unique position of being certain that when I harvest it, I know it is done right, which is one of the greatest motivations, I think, to learn these traditional methods.
Okay. So now, I think that, you know, as we're wrapping up this podcast now, I one of the things I want to point out just real quickly is that you and I have talked a little bit about having you come out here to Montana, western Montana, not central Montana, but western Montana, where I am, and possibly doing a workshop. We haven't finalized dates or anything like that, but I think I do want to express that if we do it, it will be announced on the Daily-ish email. And it's, I have every expectation that it will be sold out within 24 hours after announcing it. So I think once it is announced, folks might want to just jump right on that. Anything else you want to add to this podcast, Brandon?
If we make it out to Montana, which I certainly plan on doing, these classes are the best way. We've gotten a lot of questions about how to learn how to do this. What are the resources? But really, you need the knife in your hand. And that's what I do. Those are the classes that Meatsmith offers all over the Puget Sound region. I've even been to Florida, New Hampshire to do this, and Arkansas. But hands-on knowledge, the doing, is the best way to learn to do this. And I'll say when we do a class, not if. That will be what we do. It'll be hands on, and I think that's that's the best way to imbibe this tradition, to remember the tradition that we have forgotten, basically.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. If you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about food preservation, homesteading, and permaculture all the time.